Falk Eisermann has been head of the Gesamtkatalog, the Wagendruck Union Catalog of Incunabula at the Berlin State Library since 2007. After receiving his PhD in medieval German literature at Göttingen University in 1995, he held postdoctoral positions at the University of Münster and Groningen in the Netherlands, where he worked on a three-volume catalogue of 15th century broadsides published in 2004. From 2002 to 2007, he catalogued German medieval manuscripts at Leipzig University Library. He has published on the transmission of vernacular texts in the later Middle Ages, on manuscripts, incunabula and early printing, and on medieval and early modern epigraphy. Welcome to the Bibliophile.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Perhaps you could start by telling me what your role here at the Staatsbibliothek is.
Yeah, I'm head of a subdivision, you could call it. In German, it's called a Referat. subdivision of the manuscript department. And this subdivision has the task of caring for our incunable collection. So that's the Incunabel Referat in German. And I'm also in this function the editor-in-chief of the Gesamtkatalog der Wiegendrucke, the Union Catalog of Incunabula. So that's the two main tasks here. Shortly after 1990, it was decided that the Incunable department, which until then was independent, in East Berlin, just in this building where we're sitting, would be part of the manuscript department. The reasoning was that incunabula have much more to do with manuscripts than with later modern printed books, which would be found in our rare books department, the neighboring department, so to speak.
Okay, and that's interesting because incunabula, 1450 to 1500, in fact, to January 1st, 1501,
December 31st.
Oh, okay. Is it the 1st or is it 31st?
It's the 31st of December.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And so if it was printed on the 1st of January, it's not.
Exactly.
Wow.
So there is actually one incunable that was printed on the 31st of December 1500, and we consider that the last one, right?
Okay.
And to tell one story about that, a couple of years ago, one of these Venice imprints from the 31st of December 1500 was on sale, and I thought we need to have one copy of that because we have got the first printed book, the Gutenberg Bible, so we need the last one printed in the 15th century. And I went to my director general and said exactly these words, and she was like, yes, we do that, we buy it. And I'm always putting it on display when people are around, often, not always, because I'm saying, you know, this is the starting point, the Gutenberg Bible, which cannot be on display all the time. And this is the end point, as it were, but we all know that it's really just...
it's arbitrary.
Yes,
isn't
of course, it is.
And who came up with that?
That was very early in the 16th or 17th century when, arbitrary, as you say, when this explanation of the cradle of printing came up, and they said, let's put it on this date, because people just love round dates. It could have been 1480, it could have been 1520, perhaps it would have been much more logical to put it on 1520 or so. But then, I mean, this half century is big enough for a big project like ours to keep us busy for now 117 years, right? So, because the Gesamtkatalog was founded in 1904.
Yes, now this is something different. What is this that was founded in 1904?
The Union Catalogue of Incunabula. In brief, we say GW.
Yes.
So the Gesamtkatalog der Wiegendruck, founded by, among other people, the guy you can see here on the painting, Konrad Hebler, who was one of the masterminds of incunabula scholarship around 1900.
Okay. So what is his big claim to fame then?
Well, first of all, he was part of the committee that founded this Gesamtkatalog, and he's also the man who invented a typographical analysis method that we're still using today, the Typenbestimmung, so the so-called Hebler method, which is a bit different from these other type analysis methods that had been used before that, developed by Henry Bradshaw and Robert Proctor and so on. And his type repertory is still a basis of our work today, also available as a database.
I don't understand.
Look, if you have a 15th century book, which, for example, does not have a proper impressum, like the Gutenberg Bible, no word about Johann Gutenberg in it, no date, no place of printing. Then you go to look at the types and you try to find out which printer used this kind of type, because all the types in the 15th century were more or less different from each other, especially from one workshop to the next, from one city to the next, etc.
So there's a question of linking the map to the right
exactly
printer.
And then in a normal case, say not in the in a Gutenberg's case, but in a normal case, you would have comparative material from dated prints, from localized prints, prints with full colophones saying that was printed by so-and-so in Venice on the 21st of January 1494. And then you would compare this material with unassigned books, and then you could come to a certain grade of reliability when you do that. We have two people actually who are type analysts and are very specialized in applying this method to prints, to editions that are being described for the Gesamtkatalog, because we have a big database, the Gesamtkatalog der Liegendrucke database, but we're also publishing printed installments in regular intervals. And for this, we do a real in-depth descriptions of all bibliographical aspects of these prints.
So what did he do?
He published this Typen Repertorium, where all the printers that then were known with their type material were described.
I see.
All type was described, was classified. He also invented the so-called M tables. So by the uppercase M, he was able to group certain scripts together in the Gothic script. Not in the Antiqua or the Roman type, but for the Gothic script, you can call it like a biological systematic, like you would order beetles or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
Or
species and
species and so on.
Yeah.
And so this is in a way related to that. And it's not undisputed.
No.
And not even today. Not, but we are applying it ever since we started. Not we, but our predecessor started with the GW. And we think it still works very nicely. Even though we have to admit that there are some cases where we cannot really say something except this is probably something from France or England or the Netherlands, but we do not really know.
Okay.
So a famous case is the Dutch proto-typography, so the 14th, 16th, 17th, 18th case, where very many prints were published in a certain kind of type, but there's absolutely no name attached to it or attachable to it, and also not a place. And it's a big group of strange matter, so to speak, typographically, that has not been assigned to a place or a person. And that's one of the tasks that is different from what other repertories and online databases on Incunabula or early printing do, because we are about the only institutional organization that deals with this kind of stuff. There are lots of colleagues that are very experienced, of course, at the British Library, big experts. The British Library catalogue that was finished a couple of years ago is one of our most important tools to work with.
But your work trying to identify stuff that hasn't been identified
exactly.
yet is...
Or which needs to be put under the glass again, because it has been wrongly assigned or just tentatively or so.
Okay.
So that's practically an everyday job we are doing here.
So that was my next question. What do you do day to day?
Unfortunately, I'm the head of this subdivision, so I do almost everything except the good work.
And what's the good work?
The good work is, for example, to deal in depth with individual prints, so and to do descriptions, make descriptions for the Gesamtkatalog.
Okay.
So we have a task. We need to publish an installment of the GW every 2 or 3 years, and that has a number of about 200, 250 bibliographical entries each installment. And this in-depth work is enormously time-consuming, and because we are describing things that, like the textual form that this edition presents, of course the collational aspects, the materiality of the book, of the edition, And of course the type analysis, which can be in major, in large books or in books from remote places, can be quite interesting and time consuming.
So that's what fascinates you. Is that why you got into this? Is in order to sort of look at this type, this printing, and say, and be able to say, yes, well, we know that it came from this particular printer, and this is why. You're just making an argument, aren't you?
That was certainly one of the points. I had done this before with this catalog of broadsides, of the 15th century broadsides, so I got myself a little bit of amateur experience in this regard with type analysis and so on.
Yeah.
But basically I got here because I like to make catalogs. So I did one for my PhD thesis on manuscripts, on medieval manuscripts. Then I did this broadside catalog. Then I did another manuscript catalog for an individual library in Gotha. And then when I saw that this job...
It's your dream job, then, is it?
Absolutely. There is no second post like this in the world. Because there's no similar project to this one.
What's so exciting about making a catalog?
It's exciting is to work with the books, with the incunables, and when you take a look at the database of the GW altogether, we have about like 30,000 or so editions we are dealing with, in about 500,000 copies. So that's a world catalog, right?
Yes.
Not for our own holdings. We also have 4,600 incunables here,
right,
from all areas, basically.
But what's so exciting about doing a catalog?
Seeing it finished.
What's your goal?
Our goal is to deliver or to present descriptions of all the 15th century printing that is preserved and known. That is, of course, a never-ending job. I mean, we keep finding new material on an almost everyday basis.
On Twitter, even, right?
On Twitter, yes. on Instagram, on...
Yes.
Wherever, I mean,
right.
There is a Twitter hashtag incunabula, which really, I even though I'm not on Twitter, I look at it every now and then,
yeah,
because people have been presenting some very interesting findings there, and there are other. I mean, normally it's colleagues writing an email saying, "Look, I've got this book, I cannot identify it, or this broadside, or whatnot."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then you take a look and you say either, "Yeah, that's that and that," or you say, "Ooh." And then it gets really interesting.
Then you get excited because, hey, it's not in our catalog, and now we've got a new one.
Now we've got a new one. And I mean, I won't... it's not that there are so many new ones every day that numbers are really rising dramatically, but still there are quite
like
a number.
How many? Once a month?
It happened that a couple of years ago, within 30 minutes, I found six undescribed broadsides.
Okay.
And I didn't even move from my desk. I mean, I found it in a database, and the descriptions there were no digital images available, but the descriptions were good enough to tell me this is not on our files. Okay?
Right.
So because either the author did not show up in the files, the date didn't fit, or the material description, 31 lines or so, didn't fit. So I knew I have to order images, and then we'll see. It turned out that were six in 30 minutes. Then again, there are maybe 6 months or so where not much happens.
Yes.
So I think we have a backlog of things that need to be entered into our database, which is about, well, I won't really risk to say, a number between 50 and 100 editions that still need to be processed.
So you're just like a collector, because that's what collectors do. That's what we do.
Yeah.
We've got a field that we try to narrow down, and then we go after stuff that we don't have.
Absolutely. But, I mean, it's also, of course, the sheer fascination of having so many of the rarest book in the world at your disposal in our collection, right? So this 4,600 makes us like a player in the middle region of numbers. Munich has like 20,000, London has 12,000. Stuttgart, Vienna, they have more than we have, but we also lost about 4,000 in World War II. So, and that the good thing is that we can still acquire and buy quite a number of items each year. And
that is a good thing. You still got a budget to do that.
Yeah, yeah. The last one just came in a couple of weeks ago. We still have a budget, also due to the many losses in the war. So we are eager to fill the gaps. And we also have criteria that are a little bit different from what other libraries or collectors collect, because we are always looking for interesting typographical specimina that we do not have in the collection, or which are underrepresented. So rare printers from French provincial printing houses, for example, I would love to buy some English stuff. I've been trying a number of times during my tenure here in the last 14 years, but that's really very, very expensive, and so many other colleagues are chasing that. I mean, when a Kexen comes up for sale, that's way out of our league normally. Because that's one of the large gaps in our collection. We have almost no English 15th century printing here.
Well, if there's a bookseller that's got some of that stuff, they should get a hold of you then.
Yeah, but they should also get hold of some big donation fund or so.
Yes.
I mean, we had support, and we are still enjoying support from some important institutions like the Breslau Foundation, and we were able to buy some wonderful stuff thanks to their support.
The Breslau, is that the bookseller?
The former great bookseller, Bernie.
Hmm.
And
there's a foundation that they put.
They support libraries when they want to acquire special stuff.
Oh, interesting.
And we had some lucky acquisitions, not only incunabula but also manuscripts and other stuff. And so we're very grateful for that, because we do not have this. This culture of donating stuff like it is in the United States or so, in Germany. Alumni or so at universities, they will not give their rich book collections to their own home institution normally. So,
but they'll just go to the highest bidder?
Yeah. So we see it quite a lot that even famous private collections are put on sale and dispersed, as everybody knows who reads auction catalogs every now and then.
Yeah.
And that is, of course, one of the other interesting aspects of this job, that I have to go through to look at a market in a way. We cannot buy much, but every now and then we can. But it's more interesting is to observe how books are moving around. You know, I've seen this copy there. I know this is a famous copy. Wow, no, this is now there. Where will it end up? Or where will it show next? So it would be very interesting to put a GPS transmitter on all of these books to see where they are, right?
Or where, especially you're saying they're very rare, so there aren't many of them.
There are some copies that have been, some copies of famous illustrated books, say, that have been in the trade and in private collections for decades, and then perhaps stayed in one collection for 10 or 20 or 50 or 25 years, but then when an estate had to be dealt with, then the heirs would probably sell the books and keep the paintings or something like that, and you would see the books again that last time showed up 20 years in an auction. And sometimes these are really spectacular books.
Oh. I don't understand. Why does it make a difference so that you've got a GPS attached to them?
So that I know where the books are.
Well, so that you can buy them? Or
no, just to know where they are.
Just so that if you wanted to research them, then you could call them and see if they would give you access.
We have files that go back like 110 years. And so some of those files are saying in the collection of so-and-so.
Yeah.
And then I want to know, especially in the case of very rare books, where is this one now?
Yes.
Often you look at, say, like, you see there's a copy of that in the Pierpont Morgan Library, or in the British Library, or in the Library of Congress, or sometimes even with us. And then you can say, just, okay, this must be the book that was mentioned in 1910 or 15 in the private collection.
So it's like WorldCat, that kind of idea.
Yeah.
But
WorldCat for 15ers, yeah. yeah, it's a bit like that.
Okay.
I mean, this is just a side branch of the many things we are doing, but it's always very interesting as soon as it comes to really, really rare stuff, right?
Yes. So that you have a database so that you know where everything is, access it if you need to.
Well, it's our database, it's on public record, everybody can look at it, and everybody can write to us, and people do it quite a lot, saying, okay, this copy that according to your file is in a private collection no longer is, because it has been bought by whoever,
yes.
Huntington Library, Yale.
Yes.
That is a bit like a flea circus. Can you say that? Like, things are going all over the place all the time, but we catch them sooner or later, I hope.
Okay,
and then when they go into an institutional library, we assume that they'll remain there forever.
So they stop moving around.
We all know even institutional libraries sell things every now and then, duplicates. It used to be very common to sell duplicates, but...
Yeah, and again, the ultimate objective is to provide a resource to researchers who are interested in
absolutely
these books.
So that is why the GW also has copy lists, of course, of every copy that is on the record. Some of them take from very, very old files that we still keep here, inventories that were compiled in the beginning of the 20th century, when the work at the GW started, so that we can say there used to be a copy of this item in the church library at so-and-so village in Saxony, because one of our predecessors saw it there, and then we go check, is it still there? Does this library still exist? Or if not, where has it gone? And then you have masses and masses of incunable catalogs, national catalogs, regional, local, for private collections. And so we're adding these data to the GW all the time.
So it's a massive catalog of catalogs.
Also, yeah, that's also true, yeah. We have a bibliography there in our data sets so that everybody can go and look up the individual catalogs and very many online catalogs, of course, to which we are now linking. So if you click on a copy, say, in the Morgan Library, because they have a very good online incunable catalog, then the reader is being redirected to this Morgan entry and can look at the description of the local copy, because that's not what we're providing. We do not do copy description, but we do edition description, but the links lead you on to the concrete item in the collections. This is a work in progress, I need to say. We have got like...
That's the vision.
35,000 data sets with 500,000 incunables, so we are just in the very beginning of this. And there are also partner projects like the Incunabula Short Title Catalog, the ISTC, and Material Evidence in Incunabula, MAI, as we call it, who are very, very helpful for our research, and we are cooperating on a daily basis with these persons and guys.
And so your passion then is to organize everything. But the reason you're doing this is because you're passionate about getting order from chaos.
Yes, in a way. Yeah.
That's what really turns your crank.
Yeah, in a way. Also, I mean, I've got five people in my sub-department working mainly on the GW. So much more time, they spend much more time with creating the data than I can. I'm also responsible for our new manuscript reading room here and the reference library, which is also since 2 years, I have to say, so that's relatively new for me. This is also a job that can be quite time-consuming. I'm a bit of the guy on top who has to do all the rest.
The administration as well, too.
Not too bad with the administration, but that's more my supervisor's job. But still, there's lots of internal organization going on. And of course, I also try to participate in scholarly exchanges as often as I can. So before the pandemic, I went to quite a number of conferences. And now we are in a permanent exchange in online sessions and so on.
So we've gotten to what drives you as a person. As far as the Incunabula itself is concerned, basically this movable type is trying to replicate the manuscripts. It's trying to replicate writing in many cases, correct?
In the initial stages of printing, yes, of course. I mean, which other kind of script would they use? But that gets a little bit different, say, from the mid-1470s or so relatively quick, because book design begins to change, types begin to change, the typographers themselves develop more scripts and ideas for their scripts, and which are more practical and for what purposes and so. And also the method of hand coloring and illustrating changes with the time.
Yes. Specifically what? Can you give some specifics?
Well, for example, in the early German illustrated books, you would have woodcuts that were that needed to be colored by hand. Mm-hmm. But later on, the woodcutters developed, Albrecht Dürer was one of them, right? So developed techniques and new qualities of their artisan work, that so that you don't really need to do that anymore, because the structure of the image itself is I don't know how to say that in English, so the Schraffuren, so and everything, they and the shading and everything, they substituted for the color. So if you have copies of the Nuremberg Chronicle which are colored, very nice to look at, but they didn't need to be colored to be a complete book. Okay, whereas in the 14th, when you have an illustrated book from the 1460s or so, or 70s, without color, this would be just very schematic, probably not too sophisticated looking illustrations in the book. And also for the initials, which in still back until the end of the century, were often added by hand, but more often than later on, they were just printed. And some of the initial alphabets that the printers developed are works of art, really.
It became the mechanization of coloring.
In a way, putting different shades of gray, as you could say,
yes,
to the images, and so that not every buyer would feel the need to complete these books like the Nuremberg Chronicle, because yeah, they came out of the press complete, except for the binding perhaps. You don't need it any
hand coloring to
working
become,
over hand yeah coloring. Of course, the rubrication is different because that was in practice for quite a long time. But printing in red was not so. Gutenberg experimented with it, but only a bit, and it took a while to take hold later on. So many rubrics and column titles and other chapter titles in early prints were also added by hand, and only in the later years they were printed in red, which is quite some feat for some printers, for most of the printers. And there are new studies about that which are absolutely fascinating about printing in color. So that's one of the branches of scholarship that has really seen a great improvement in the past couple of years.
Hmm. And this is because new technology was introduced.
Well, let's say the technology of printing was improved. The longer, the more experience the printers got,
yeah,
and the more printers there were. I mean, there was a handful of people. They're all obviously coming from Mainz, from the earliest workshops.
Yeah.
And then they spread out exponentially very quickly. So there were a lot more people who just knew how this was to be done. And of course, they were always working to improve the technique, even though, as we know, the printing press itself did not much change until the 18th, 19th century. So,
mm-hmm.
But they became very experienced in printing, say, with gold, in printing with three colors, in printing on parchment, on vellum, in printing complicated mathematical figures in the margins of their book, and so on. Upside down printing. So it's astonishing to see how the development, especially in the 1470s, takes a big step forward and rushes to new heights then.
Specifically, what skills improved? Like, what allowed them to print better?
Well, the typesetting, for one thing. The type making.
Why was it better?
I'm not really sure how to put that, but the more they worked with the type and the material, the more they learned about that, I think, and more talented people joined the
business. So it became more legible? They experimented with that?
And more diverse, and so that you could do more things with, you could have larger types, smaller types. The Roman was praised, Roman type was praised as more legible, Aldus Manutius, and the Italic is a famous story. So,
and that's where most incunabula, you break down the different countries, Italy was right at the top.
Absolutely.
And then Germany and down the line.
Yeah, well, there were, of course, there was good stuff from Italy and bad stuff, typographically
yes.
speaking. So
yeah.
you have got this famous itinerant printers who probably had a not only movable type, but were movable types themselves. So
yeah.
they ran around with a small press, perhaps, or they changed presses, or they lent presses. It's always a problem that we are dealing with when people are exchanging their material, especially their type. Then you can imagine it's hard to say this was printed by so-and-so because it is in his type, but when he gave the types away or sold them, and sometimes you can prove it, you know it, and that became much more fashionable, or much more the normal case in the 16th century is that that the businesses get different. You have the book printer, but the typographer is a different person. So the guy who makes the type.
Well, and then that moves on to the graphic designer eventually,
absolutely.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got it gets very generic from there on, and that's why you don't have a type repertory for the 16th century. You could probably have one for the first two decades or so. Try out how long it takes to discern the types of individual printers. It has been done for Wittenberg, I think, and other famous places, but on the whole, as soon as the standardization and the general spread of type selling takes on, you cannot say anymore, this was printed by so-and-so and so-and-so. It could as well be in the next village because they used the same type, or because big workshops exchanged their material regularly, and some professional type sellers sold their stuff all over Europe. So,
yeah,
end of story.
So to start with, there were a handful of people who knew how to print, and then you say they sort of spread out, and then
yeah.
they taught people. Do you have numbers on how that grew over the first, say, 50, 100 years?
I think that got from Mainz to about 400 places in Europe where at the end of the 15th century there were printing offices. Two and a half thousand or so workshops, but of course some of those were big and lasted for quite a while, like Schoeffer's in Mainz, or Koberger, and some of the Venetian.
Why was Venice such a big deal?
I've got a colleague who can answer that much better than I can.
Okay.
I suppose you ask Christina Dondi about that. So at Oxford. She's the biggest living expert on that. Venice was just the hotspot place, like the Silicon Valley? The Silicon Valley. It was just the political and economical power that was already assembled there, plus the strategic position in the middle of Europe. And a big influx of, for example, German printers who remained there or who learned the trade there, and some of them are very famous persons. But of course, German printers were all over the place in the first decades, in France, in Spain, in Italy.
They were in demand, I guess,
they
got paid pretty well.
And there must have been a kind of enormous apprentice system, so that people sent out their guys, the guys went themselves, to found new enterprises elsewhere.
There's also, obviously there's the expertise, but there's also the presses themselves. They had to be made, or
yeah.
there had to be plans for those to be,
yeah.
how they were made.
Yeah.
What about that?
Well, they wouldn't only learn to how to print a book, they would also learn how to build a press. I don't know, there are not many documents about how this technique was really exported. You just have to imagine it must have been exported, because how else would books crop up in Spain in the early 1470s and everywhere else? They just took their knowledge, be it in the form of a machine or just in their brains or on paper or so,
yeah.
and then they would start to build things up for themselves. So all those presses will look basically the same.
Yeah,
as you can see from the books that were produced on them. But of course, there was one technical improvement from the so-called one-pull press to the two-pull press, but it's very difficult to explain, and I'm not an expert on that, in the 1470s, which slowly took hold, which enormously produced the speed, sped up the production, I should say, production, and made it possible to deal with more complex books in a much quicker way than before. So enormous developments, for which lots of people who are much cleverer than I am have written about. Yeah, so that is certainly the most important point in the spread. The people on the one hand, and the machines, which got better and better, and probably also more available at places.
Well, and then of course there must have been all sorts of people who could then get their ideas out that the authorities didn't want getting out.
Were
these printing presses just placed or purchased by people who could afford them? So it was the messages of the rich, and obviously people who could read would sort of take in this information. But Luther is the obvious example of the church didn't necessarily want him translating from the Latin and putting his spin on it and having people read from a source other than the church.
He wasn't the first translator who was who got opposition from the church. In the 1480s, the first censorship edict was published already, and it related to translation to vernacular Bibles in Germany, published by the Archbishop of Mainz, to absolutely no avail. I mean,
yes.
Except in Mainz, perhaps,
yes.
Because
right.
Of all the many, many German translations before Luther, I don't think that there was one published in this Archdiocese of Mainz, but of course published in places like Augsburg and Nuremberg and elsewhere, and in the Low German region. So one edition, one new translation after the next, or improved translation.
Well, approved and unapproved, I would assume.
I don't think so, because we actually don't have much information about how these commissions for these big books worked. When they don't say themselves, so-and-so gave the money to translate this. And sometimes it says so. So he's the publisher of this book, and that can of course be famous people, like again in the Nuremberg Chronicle, it's two famous citizens of Nuremberg who paid for everything, who commissioned the compilation of the text, who commissioned the images and so on. But the Bibles never say so, at least not the German ones. So I think they were from the beginning a big commodity which the printers just produced.
Yes.
Because the manuscripts were already available, which they could use for the text.
They could just take the manuscript
and
put it into type.
Right, and then once that had proven successful, they would just go on. And so an archbishop could never stop that kind of business. It was a self-running automatism by then. In other countries it was different. We know that in Spain Bible printing was suppressed very dramatically in the vernacular, also in Latin, I think. And in England, of course, no English translation of the Bible in the 15th century, no printed translation exists. So that was a special situation. And so all the situations in the various countries and cities are special. For example, a university might feel the need to bring in a printer for their textbooks, right? So and then they would probably appoint someone, or they would go to a local printer and say, okay, you already have a press, can you please print our textbooks from now on, and we'll be paying you, which would be a good idea for a printer.
Mm-hmm.
And church authorities, of course, paid for lots of liturgical printing. Everybody knows that. Sometimes even so far that workshops were moved from A to B in order to proceed with certain printing jobs that they needed to do. Because in one famous case, it was the pandemic was on in at Leipzig. So the Leipzig workshop was used 100 miles away, 100 kilometers away, to a different location where they produced the one and only book that was printed at this place, at Freiberg in Sachsen, a missal for a diocese.
But what you need to know, of course, is who's paying for it.
Yeah.
And if someone's paying for it, they typically have a say in what it says.
They would probably, in the case of liturgical printing, it is very clear that they would provide the copy text. So, but liturgical printing, of course, is standardized in a way, but also changing very often and regionally. I mean, if you are dealing with texts that can turn out to be controversial, then in a very small number of cases, we know that they really turned out to be controversial, so that they were disputed, suppressed, or forgotten, forbidden, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there's one thing that I find endlessly interesting: a Low German translation of a large work by Jan Hus, which appeared in the 1470s in Lübeck. You know, as I said, in a Low German translation. But what was really just a piece of devotional literature, as it was also produced in the same time by Franciscans and other people, with not so many suspicious points in the text that people would obviously notice. But still, this Hus imprint, and it's going under his name, even though it nowhere says that it is a text by Hus, it was translated into Low German, and it was published as an incunable in Germany during the late 1470s, I think, or in the late 1470s. So that is some kind of, call it subversive literature that went totally under the radar.
Yeah, so no wonder there were revolutions and uprisings and, it's so political, isn't it?
It is, but you know, again, I think that in the 15th century, the audiences were so diverse, and also the interests of the institutions were so diverse. Germany was split up into a lot of fiefdoms and regions and local rulers and independent cities, and the emperor or the king always had trouble keeping this other flea circus together. So if you print something in Augsburg, nobody sitting in Nuremberg or in Frankfurt or in Cologne could really get to you about that. So I mean, there are some interesting points in the correspondence of the German king, Maximilian, where he bitterly complains about some printers who published stuff that was directed against him as early as around 1500. And he says, he especially notes that the printers in Strasbourg are somewhat rebellious, and he threatens them with serious charges. I don't know what came out of this. I only know that it was it had to do with money. Of course, right?
So, of course.
And it had to do with indulgences, as in later times with Luther.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was quite a bit of money involved, and Maximilian didn't like that at all. So, but this kind of affairs are really rare in the 15th century. So
okay.
The control of the market or censorship also, it happens every now and then, but it's not as widespread as is generally assumed.
Well, the other thing too is not that many people could read, so you need to get a larger reading audience.
Well, you would have a large reading audience in certain stratas of society, of course, in the parish priests, the monks, the city officials, university persons, hopefully very many of the academics.
Hopefully, yes.
I mean, we know as academics, of course, but we know that some priests and some people who had studied didn't really know the basics of the Christian faith and so on. But at least, you know, there was quite a large audience, especially when, as some of these book dealers, book printers and publishers later did, they had international markets in mind.
Right, of course.
Like, again, our standard example, the Nuremberg Chronicle, was from the beginning focused on an international market. They had a distribution net, and they were selling the Latin text, that is, or trying to sell it all over the place.
Because that had the largest audience, the largest readership, and the Latin was pretty common, right?
Yeah, you could buy it, sell it in Italy, you could sell it in France. And they did, or at least they tried, even though they didn't sell as many as they wanted to. And there was a German translation, and that was, of course, limited to the German market, but still big, estimated as big enough to make a relatively high print run, especially for this market and for this massive book, right?
Yeah.
And so...
Well, yeah, they had to sort of try as best they could to limit their liability and to ensure that they'd make as much money as possible from it.
Absolutely. I mean, probably starting with Gutenberg, but also with there are very many other printers who just...
They didn't make much money. I mean, Gutenberg went bankrupt, right?
Well, it has recently been disputed
if that was
really the case, but that's pretty complicated. We know, in a couple of cases, we know that people went bankrupt and had to flee from the cities and turned up elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even one printer who did it twice, I think. But, and of course, the main thing is the investment in paper and work, in paper and staff and so on. And then you have to get your money back from the buyers. But I mean, I think there was a large audience for this kind of stuff. Otherwise, we wouldn't have 30,000 surviving imprints from the 15th century with however many copies there once were. 10 million, 20 million, 30 million is all estimates. 500,000 are still surviving. And so, and we'd just have to take a look at the books themselves and see that they... Very many readers left their marks in them.
Literally. Yes, yes. Speaking of the content, it's mostly religious.
Well,
the number of books that
there are a number of quantifications, but it's basically everything, right? So, of course, there's much theology. There's much of the life sciences, like medicine, and law. Of course, so very many of these books are really substantial textbooks with commentaries, not unlike the law students of these days have on their desks. Then, of course, the whole vernacular stuff, which is different from country to country, and humanist writings, beginning editions of classical authors.
I was going to say that Aldus Manutius was big on that.
Aldus was big on it, but Cicero started in the 1460s and went on, and other Virgil too. So this is really as colored as it gets. And so there is one book which deals at least in parts with variations of French cheese. And one book about
illustrated.
I don't know. No, it's a humanist treatise saying that a description of certain areas of France, mentioning that the cheese there is especially good. One obscure French item that I've recently come across, in which obviously the dog is a main actor, but I haven't got deeper into that, and lots of. A totally interesting material, the first female orator, Cassandra Fidelis, got some of her stuff printed.
So it isn't just religious.
It isn't just
and
religious.
And it's not all boring.
No. And even, I mean, I've done lots of work on religious texts and I don't find them boring at all, but I know that they can be always about the same things, but, you know, there's... super interesting material still to be found in texts that have been, or in editions that have been described but have never been analyzed from the content. And I just recently heard a paper by a Dutch scholar about some of these vernacular Dutch devotional books which had been described in their materiality but not from what they contain, how they are being put together, of what sources they have and so on. So the textual scholarship, which normally is, or which really is an academic discipline, this is totally incomplete on Incunabula. So there's one project underway now that is called Text Inc. So in order to just find out which texts and in what shape and where were printed, because we are far from knowing all the things. Every time that we do new installments of the printed GW, almost every time, when we go through the books very thoroughly, we find bits and pieces of text or even complete text inserted somewhere or added to,
yes,
or printed with or so that nobody had ever noticed before, really, literally. And then you have to do some digging as well. So an interesting...
Fragments are interesting.
Fragments are a completely different kettle of fish. They've been keeping us busy for years and will continue to do so, because there are really quite a number of editions that survive as fragment only. So in one case, we just have a couple of square centimeters of parchment where you can identify what text it was from, but you have no idea where the rest of the copy and the whole edition has gone. So,
well, and digitization allows for different fragments to be sort of pieced together digitally. Right?
Yeah,
well,
is
exciting.
Yeah, that is more the fashion in manuscript studies at the moment.
Oh, okay.
But we have done that once this year with a very interesting case. Our first new acquisition in 21 was a fragment from an official proclamation by King Maximilian, 1499. And when we compared our records, we thought, oh, there's the same text also in fragments. It was a fragment about a quarter of a big sheet in upper left corner. And there are fragments by the same printer of the same text, which are in the British Library, but they have been recorded as different issues.
Yes.
And then we got digital images from the British Library and put our copy virtually against them, and we saw, okay, this belongs not only to the same print, but to the same copy, because it was cut in the middle, in the upper part, and it was just one letter missing, and you could see how the scissors
like
went
a jigsaw,
along
there, yeah.
Or the bookbinder's knife, rather.
Yes, yes.
And so we now have the interesting case that we have a copy that is kept in one quarter in our collection, two quarters or half of it, upper right part, lower right part in the British Library, and the lower left part is still missing. So a third library can join in if they find it. But we rarely do that, really, because for broadsides it makes sense sometimes, but if you try to piece together let's say Aquinas edition, which survives in so and so many hundred copies plus fragments, it doesn't really make sense. It makes sense, of course, for the Gutenberg Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense in cases where you know that a complete or almost complete copy has been taken apart. Not too long ago, that was a fashion for so-called leaf books. So you would take a copy apart and then sell it the pages with some kind of leaf book.
I'm just trying to get to the local, you know, the current collector. And I did a quick search online. For about $100, you can get pages of Incunabula.
Yeah, yeah. I've got two pages of Nuremberg Chronicle, two leaves,
yeah,
of a Nuremberg Chronicle, the pirate edition from 1496, which is to blame for the commercial disappointment that the original edition turned out to be. And that was sold when a bookshop in Münster were sort of moving, and they sold these things for like folio pages with images on them, because they were just moving out and getting rid of all their stock. And there was a whole box books full of Schädel leaves for 10 to 20 Deutschmarks back then, so half of that. And I was still a PhD student and took a handful and gave couple of them away to friends of mine, but I still have got one here in my in my cabinet, actually, because I'm using it when I go teaching in the university.
Yeah.
So I can take one original leaf with me. I cannot obviously take our things from our own collection, so but that is mine. And my colleague of Oliver Dunze and I, we often think we should begin buying these small fragments just for exactly that purposes, so that we can take them to the students instead of bringing the students here.
So they can actually touch it.
Touch it and,
yeah,
and do things with it, whatever, to look for the watermarks and make type analysis and so. But then there's the thing that we really don't want to be part of this deal in fragments. So because the more you sell, the more you produce, and so
right. So in other words, it would encourage sellers to tear books
in a way
apart.
I mean that there are hundreds, thousands, perhaps even more of these leaves are circulating, and but I really would hate to see that we took part in that and thus created new demands for that. So
some of these
leaves are really nice and sometimes quite expensive. I mean, if a leaf from the Gutenberg Bible is not that cheap, and and if you have a fragment from an early Gutenberg Donatus, this grammar, which was published in various editions, obviously by the earliest typographers, and most of these do only survive in fragments, and then you can really pay prices unheard of, because these are all constitute unique copies of unknown Gutenberg imprints, right? And I know a couple of libraries who have really paid quite a lot of money for that. And if you find a new Donatus or a new fragment of it.
What's a Donatus?
A grammar, a Latin basic grammar, which was a total top seller in the 15th century and also even in the manuscript time, because that was how school boys, I don't say school boys and girls because it was obviously just boys then, how school boys learned their Latin with this book in hand. And as it was heavily used, it was often printed on parchment, vellum, and the case, the GW article on the Donatus is endless, and most of them, the descriptions are it's only describing fragments of what used to be variant or different editions from the earliest presses, so from Gutenberg and very early Schoeffer imprints, but also very many other editions from other presses that just survive in one of these parchment leaves that was bound in or used as a book cover, or so otherwise got the whole rest got lost. So,
well, they were also heavily used.
Yeah, they were heavily used by the kids by the students, and of course they would get rid of a copy as soon as it was no longer of use, because they had learned everything and it would have probably been...
they thought they'd learned everything.
Yes, and they could easily get access to a new one if they needed one, but I mean, this is really a very short book. You can learn it by heart, the rules that are in a couple of hours perhaps. So,
So
that would be the basics of the Latin, and then they would continue to go to other more different, more difficult and elaborated textbooks.
Okay.
So the Donatus is really a primer. So at the primer, very beginning of everything, and thus it was also discarded off very easily. But today it's, you know, like, wow, if you get a Gutenberg Donatus, you're a made man. If you find one in your attic, so.
Oh, okay. Just to winding down. So what does the what's your advice for someone who wants to learn more and find out more about incunabula? What should they do?
Well, it's a very specialized, not to say, I mean, I often say we are a bit nerdy, you know?
People who have listened all the way to this probably know that.
Yeah. Those people are nerds themselves, because they probably are incunabulists themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very specialized branch. There are a couple of introductions to incunabula scholarship, also available mostly by German authors, but also available in English. Konrad Häbler wrote the first, I think, in 1925, that was translated into English and Italian and other languages. It's a bit outdated, but there are newer ones. There are good articles on incunabula in Wikipedia and also on the Gesamtkatalog der Wiegenrucke, if one wants to. I mean, depends also from which country you come. I don't really know what in American library science schools is being taught when it comes to incunabula, which kind of book. It's more as part of the bibliographic syllabus that incunabula come into play. So most of the people who are not specialized rare book librarians that are dealing with this subject these days are scholars. Like the friend we met when we came in, he was a...
What's his name?
Gerd Dicke. He used to be a professor, or he still is a professor, of medieval German literature at Eichstätt University.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote his PhD work on an incunable collection of Aesop fables.
Oh, yes.
And dozens of incunabula, very... successful book in the early German market, and he's just self-taught, right, in terms of incunabula.
Yeah.
Some universities are offering courses. I'm doing a course once a year for our library science students at the Humboldt University, but that's really just one day for manuscripts, one day for incunabula, because okay. The curriculum is very much filled up with other stuff. And we teach courses, summer schools sometimes, or as part of summer schools in Germany and also elsewhere. I've done workshops with students in St. Andrews, for example, also in the Lilly Library at Bloomington and in Harvard. So,
what's the takeaway from that course? Huh? Then, what is the takeaway that we haven't covered yet? Is there anything that we haven't really talked about?
We are teaching basic things about what is an incunable, but that's really more for the, we're telling them in advance, read a bit about this, please, because the main thing is we will work with concrete incunabula as available on the premises, and I will explain to you this is that and this is that and that's the thing and there's the problem with the binding and so on. And I will also always try to teach them what kind of information they can get from the internet, from the databases like the Gesamtkatalog, but also the ISTC and many other repertories that are available for questions like bindings, for questions like watermarks and so on. So to give them really it's normally depending on how much time we have, it's a crash course on rare book librarianship in the internet.
Okay.
And the target group is really almost everybody who's doing studies in the humanities, as insofar as they are interested in the late Middle Ages, early modern period. I've been doing that with art historians, with theologians, German philologists, English philologists, book historians, of course, library science students, whoever is interested.
Now, what's the most important message you have for them?
Don't be shy, I would say. Just go there and ask for the books, because that's one thing that I often hear. I would never have thought that I could touch a book that is 500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But in most of the libraries, especially in the United States, but also yes. here with us, people, if they're not too specialized and too, you know, touchy, people, I've experienced that in the library at Dartmouth College. So people coming in from the street saying, can you give me this and that, show me this and that book and can I touch it? And they would say, of course, sir.
That's what they were designed for in the first place.
And that's fantastic. And that's what I'm saying to the students, don't be shy, go to the libraries, go to the collections and say, I would like to see this book from 1485 because I've never seen a book from 1485 and I want to see how it's like. So, and that's one thing that we are promoting here as well, everybody here who has a reader's card and has a certain kind of interest can go to the reading room. But I often do that when we put things on public display. Like once a year, the Friends of the Library Association have a big reception event where their members of the Friends of the Library Association come in and other people too. And we have like little bookstores there and show some of our precious items, especially those who are in need of repair, because they are often donating money for conservation issues. So, and sometimes these people bring their young kids with them, and then I say, of course, well, you can touch it. Mama says, no, don't touch it. It's really right.
Or some people say you have to put gloves on. You don't have to put gloves on.
No. That is, I think it's not even disputed anymore that the majority of the book conservators say that gloves are no good, including many archivists. When it comes to illuminated manuscripts with gold and stuff like that, then it gets a bit different, and that's special conditions anyway. So, but for a normal 15th century incunable, I'm often telling the story, or You could throw it on the wall for 3 or 4 times. It would probably not be completely demolished. But if you do that with a textbook you bought in 1980 for when you were a student, it would fly away in all directions within a second. So these books are astonishingly resistant as long as they are not put into grave things like earthquakes or fire. But you know, one of my favorite stories is what I call the Dual Scooters in the Duck Pond. So that was an incunable owned by a Berlin professor of Dual Scooters, a French Franciscan scholasticist of the 13th century. And he owned an incunable, this professor. Then his house was bombed in the 1940s, 1943 or so. They managed to evacuate most of the library, but not the incunable. The Dual Scooters flew out of the window and landed in a duck pond a couple of meters away from the house. And they didn't find it at first. But then they found it about 3 weeks later, still lying in the water. They took it out, they dried it, they brought it to a bookbinder who said, the binding is probably ruined, but the rest we can get into good shape again. And then in the middle of World War II, they got some parchment from Paris, a parchment sheet that was big enough to produce a new nice binding for this pretty big incunable. And the professor kept it for another 20 years before he sold it, and the bookseller announced it as in good condition, right? So a fantastic story, and it's one of the stories that I really like about these little footnotes. This book has survived a bombing raid, right? And a duck pond, three-story and a duck pond.
Okay, final question, and that is, why is what you do important?
Well, I'm participating in a big project to preserve cultural heritage, right? So, which is basically the library here.
Why is that important?
To keep books? Well, because cultural heritage is one of the three things that makes mankind, right? Or perhaps one of the most important things that makes mankind. And because it's so endlessly fascinating, all this stuff that happened and that you have to learn about. I'm really not a very philosophical thinker about these issues, but I think if you see the interaction between people and the book, especially between people who have never interacted with such a book, then you can see almost everything in their eyes, right? So there must be much more convoluted concepts to explain why this is important, but I mean, if I can bring more information to people who need this information, that's perfectly fine for me. And also, I'm totally egoistic in this regard. This interests me endlessly. So I could do that for another 100 years if they let me, and I also would need probably another 100 years to finish the Gesamtkatalog der Wiedenrucke, because after 96 years now since the first installment appeared in 1925, and we are now a little bit over halfway through. So imagine what kind of time we would need to get all the way through, but still I think it's worth the work. All or many major projects have lasted quite a while, but they are still in use for centuries after, or they will hopefully still be in use for centuries after that, and be it digital or on as a printed book. That's what we can do to document the general cultural heritage. So especially in Berlin, where we lost so much, I find it a pretty obvious place to do some reworking of what still is there and reshaping it.
So it gives meaning, obviously, meaning and purpose to your life.
Absolutely. My wife often
keeps you alive.
My wife often complains that I'm having what is, I think in English is called a bus driver's holiday. So when I sit at home in our kitchen, I'm often reading articles on Incunabula in my spare time. I'm not supposed to do that. But that's simply the reason is that there is this one thing that we haven't mentioned yet, that is there's so much interesting research in the moment that I can hardly manage to read it in my office at times. So I need to read it on my kitchen desk, because otherwise I wouldn't read it at all, and it's fascinating. Because also very many young people are all of a sudden writing their theses and PhD works on 15th century not always on the printing itself, but on printing related things, let's put it this way.
Well, there's such an obvious parallel to what's happening now with the internet, isn't
there? The famous media revolution catchword is one aspect, but also because there has been a certain material term back in the academic world to take more closer looks at the books than not necessarily only theorize about the texts, right? So, and that was very interesting. Some medievalists are really big time into manuscript studies now, and historians are in printing history, and so also as economical and social history. So there are very, very good improvements. And then we alone had like three or four PhD students who once had an internship at the GW and then went on to write their PhD thesis on early printing, and that is something that almost never happened when I began here about 15 years ago or so.
So you're not going to be put out of a job then?
Hopefully not. No. If not a miracle happens and someone finishes this Union Catalog of Incunabula within the next, let's say, 3 or 4 years, but then, I mean, we could begin all over again, because obviously the first volumes published in 1925 needed a brush over. And also, as I said, there are new findings all the time that need to be processed. And only hope that people don't lose the interest in that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your passion and interest with
thank
me.
You.
It's been great. Falk, could you just give me and some German pronunciations? Can you just tell us again your title and your role here, and then we'll go out.
My title in German. Yeah, so I'm Referatsleiter.
Lovely.
Which is an administrative expression for a subdivision, head of a subdivision in a German institution. You also find lots of Referatsleiter in the Ministry of Defense. And elsewhere, so because we are a federal institution, right? So we report to the German government. So I'm a Referatsleiter at the Gesamtkatalog der Wiegendrucke /Inkunabelsammlung at Staatsbibliothek zu Berlin, preußischer Kulturbesitz. Quite a mouthful or a handful.
Sounds beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.